Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, New Tools in Civil Rights Cases, featuring Mark Goldfeder, Mark Greendorfer, Robert Shibley, and Mark Stern. Our moderator today is Ken Marcus. Ken is the founder and chairman of the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and former Assistant U.S. Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. He is also the chairman of the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Ken, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. Good to see you. Thank you to the panelists and to our distinguished audience, which I see includes a number of distinguished lawyers and other people. One of my favorite judges. I don't know if there are multiple judges. Your Honor, you may assume that I'm speaking about you. For everyone else, I will say that this is a very timely and important topic. There have been in recent months many new approaches, it seems, to basic civil rights topics. Including prominently, but not exclusively, anti-Semitism in higher education. There are other topics for which there have been arguably inventive approaches taken, including, for instance, aspects of Title IX. We're not limiting the discussion today, but we're also thinking that if this piques the interest or curiosity of the audience, we might have additional webinars like this in the future dealing with other specific topics as well. With respect to anti-Semitism, if you've been reading the papers, you have been seeing some of the cases, both with respect to private party litigation and also federal government investigations and lawsuits. We have been seeing not just a volume, but also a forcefulness and perhaps variation in civil rights approaches that is certainly unusual, if not unprecedented, during this administration, and of course in the wake of the October 7, 2023 atrocities and the campus activities that followed. There are lots of ways of looking at it. Some may or may not agree that we're seeing huge changes in the approach. I think most will agree to that. But then the question is, are the approaches useful, important, unprecedented? Are they legitimate? Are they well-founded in law? Where do they meet with limitations with respect to either the First Amendment, due process, or otherwise? Often we think about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Many of the prominent cases against universities have been focused on Title VI, although not always. Title VI, of course, prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in federally assisted programs or activities, like most colleges or universities. There have been many cases under Title VI, both in the federal courts and in various administrative agencies, including particularly the agency that I formerly ran, which is the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. But those cases have not just been voluminous, they've also been handled in a way that appears different in terms of their timing, in terms of the sorts of punishments, so on and so forth. Title VI is just one of many different tools that we've seen in use. That's also a difference, and one of the reasons that we come together. In order to address issues like this, we have four very creative and interesting legal thinkers of perhaps differing approach. Mark Goldfeder is the head, the founder and president of NJAC, the National Jewish Advocacy Center, a former colleague of mine, I'm pleased to say. We've worked together for many years since he was on the Emory University Law School faculty. He is an ordained minister. He is the rabbi, Dr. Mark Goldfeder. I hope it's okay if I call you Mark. In fact, virtually everyone, is it okay if I call all of you Mark. Mr. Shibley, is it okay if you're Mark?
That's fine, whatever is easiest. I don't want to be the obstacle there.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Mark Greendorfer, another one of our distinguished Marks, is the founder and head of Zachor Legal, and someone who has not only focused on various civil rights, especially anti-Semitism issues, but who has in his reports and otherwise provided, I think, clarity and creativity in thinking about civil rights law, including with respect to this so-called Ku Klux Klan Act. Mark Stern, whom I've had the pleasure to work with also over many years, is now the chief legal officer of the American Jewish Committee, former chief legal officer or general counsel of the American Jewish Congress, and I believe for a period co-executive director of that organization. Certainly one of the go-to constitutional lawyers within the American Jewish community and the nonprofit sector. Robert Shibley, a distinguished constitutional lawyer, I think career-long senior lawyer with FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. If I got the E right, I think the E, so Shibley has been the constant, the E has been the variable with respect to FIRE over the years. He is a senior counsel, having also been executive director in various other functions over there. So we have an excellent group to hear from. And with that, I will turn to our first speaker, Mark Goldfeder.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me. And again, thank you, Ken, for moderating. Ken is actually very, very modest. Let me give you a little bit more about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. For those of you who don't know our moderator, as he mentioned, it prohibits institutions of higher education and others from creating discriminatory or hostile environments for any students on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And speech crosses over from protected territory into harassing verbal conduct when it's sufficiently severe, pervasive, or persistent enough so as to interfere with or limit the ability of an individual to participate in or benefit from the services, activities, or privileges provided by a university. But from 1964 until about 2004, most people assumed that Jewish students were not protected, because if you notice, religion, for whatever reason, is not part of the protected class status in Title VI. In 2004, the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights issued a series of policy statements clarifying that although religion is not a protected class under Title VI, the department would henceforth investigate anti-Semitism complaints to the extent that they also implicate ethnic or ancestral bias. For example, discriminatory harassment based on a real or even just a perceived connection to the State of Israel. This policy today is known as the Marcus Doctrine, after its author, Kenneth L. Marcus, who was then the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Education for Enforcement. And that is the Title VI policy of the federal government, which since Executive Order 13899 in 2019 uses the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, to evaluate complaints involving allegations of anti-Jewish conduct. So this is really the first tool in any litigator's toolbox when you're trying to protect Jewish students on campus. This is no fault of Ken's, but in my opinion, Title VI doesn't usually work. And that's because Title VI is a little bit unwieldy. I think that if you read some of the enacting and promulgating regulations underneath, there's a little bit of confusion. And so the truth is that really no universities ever lose their federal funding because of Title VI complaints. In fact, if you look closely at the Harvard case, for example, while Harvard was trying to paint this as a Title VI case, the government has been very, very clear that this is not a Title VI case. They're using public policy parts of the contractual agreements, not Title VI, so as to avoid some of the pitfalls that we were discussing a second ago in the use of Title VI. What that meant practically for my organization was that post October 7th, we knew that there was going to be a tremendous amount of Title VI litigation handled by incredible people like Ken at the Brandeis Center and Mark at the Zachor and others. And so we decided to focus on branching out into some new areas. Among those areas of civil tools that we have used to try and protect students are, number one, the Anti-Terror Act. The Anti-Terrorism Act, which is codified at 18 U.S. ESC section 233.1 to 233.9D is an interesting tool in this particular context. What it does is it's a set of federal laws essentially that defines terrorism, and it provides both civil and criminal liability for acts of international and domestic terrorism. And what we decided was that after October 7th, if any of you looked at the materials that were being handed out on campus, you would have noticed something appalling, which is that they were open recruitment and PR tools of Hamas. I mean, when I say open, literally, one of the pamphlets that was handed out at Columbia University said, this is an intentional and coordinated effort to further the goals of the resistance. Unless you weren't sure what the resistance meant, it was included quotes from Hamas, the PFLP, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Okay, so that is as close to the line of what the Supreme Court in Holder versus Humanitarian Law says is literally material support as you can possibly get, unless you're intentionally trying to violate the statute. So what we did was we sued in a couple of places. In the Eastern District of Virginia, we sued National Students for Justice in Palestine. In New York, we sued Columbia University Apartheid and DeBest, the group that Mahmoud Khalil is a part of, that he was a leader of, and some other affiliated groups for material support for terror. The goal there is to make it clear. If you ever spend any time walking into any of these encampments, you'll notice something fascinating, which is that, charitably speaking, 80% of the students don't know what river and what sea, and they are there either for the pizza or because they have been genuinely misled into thinking that they are on the right side of history. And we are hopeful that if a court will allow us to prove this, then we can get that 80% to walk away and not realize that they were in bed with a terrorist organization, and we'll save 80% of our future congressmen, senators, presidents, etc., citizens even. So that's the first thing we did was the ATA. Next, we looked at ways to try and protect physically some of the spaces where the students were being harassed. And for that, we turned to the FACE Act. The FACE Act is the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. It's an abortion clinic act. But when it was getting passed in the 90s, Republicans threw in a paragraph two to try and get some more votes, which says, or houses of religious worship. Most people don't read that far down. But again, when you're dealing with useful idiots, they make useful idiot mistakes, like advertising, hey, let's go block a synagogue or a Chabad house or a Hillel house. And they tape themselves blocking a synagogue or a Chabad house or a Hillel house. And then they brag about blocking a synagogue, a Chabad house or a Hillel. So we sued them in Los Angeles. We sued Palestinian Youth Movement and Code Pink for the Adas Torah riots outside of a synagogue in Los Angeles. And thankfully, we're moving on to trial. Just an interesting little side point here for those who are interested. Ken mentioned I'm a rabbi before I was a lawyer. And so I will just mention this point in passing. You know, one of the little nuances in that particular part of the law is that there has to be an ongoing act of religious worship during the time. So we were sort of lucky during this riot. There was a 1:30 mincha service, afternoon service, and that counted, but it was a 7-hour protest. And so we explained to the judge, this was an Aliyah event, an event about helping people move to the land of Israel. We explained to the judge in writing that not only is Aliyah a mitzvah, a commandment under Jewish law, Hechsher Aliyah, preparing to make Aliyah, is also part of a commandment. And we quoted extensively from the early commentaries. And the judge in his first footnote said, basically, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. That seems like religious worship, and you're allowed to continue. And so we are moving to trial on that basis. So Aliyah is now also protected as an act of religious worship in the United States. I know that I'm getting over my time, and so I will wrap up, but just very briefly, a couple of the other things that we have explored are, number one, using a, if you look at the core of a lot of these groups, they really do function like a mafia. And so we were looking at RICO cases that we might be able to bring. It's been a long time, but we're getting hopefully closer. And with that, I guess I will, I'll turn it over. So thank you. Ken, you're on mute.
Thank you, Mark Goldfeder. Mark Greendorfer, do you care to go next?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And again, thank you for inviting me to this panel. It's an honor to be among so many esteemed attorneys, people who I actually look up to and consider my role models. So thank you. Building on what Mark said, Mark Goldfeder had just talked about with the FACE Act, one of the things that we at Zohar had noticed was the patterns on campus. If you remember what was going on back in the early days of October 7th to 2023 on, it was a very coordinated effort on campuses. And it looked a lot to us like there had been coordination not only between the administration and the students, but also foreign terror organizations. And I know that this is something that Mark has raised in his litigation. One of the things, though, that jumped out to us was also regarding the FACE Act, it protects women, especially, from obstructions in getting to abortion clinics. There's a similar law on the books called, it's often known as the criminal KKK laws, and they were enacted, there's three statutory provisions. They were enacted to protect, in the wake of abolition of slavery, the rights of Black Americans to exercise their constitutional and federal rights, from voting to assembling to simply picketing things that, you know, for example, like they, a lot of local stores and police were very active in suppressing rights of the Black, freed Black Americans. And so these laws, the KKK laws, were used as a civil and criminal means to protect them. So with that as background, if you look at what the Biden administration did for the 4 years that it was in office and prior as well under Obama, they used the criminal KKK laws, particularly 18 U.S.C. 241, which is a conspiracy statute, to go after abortion clinic protesters. And if you've ever seen an abortion clinic protest, you know what it is. It's there's some chanting. Sometimes they chain themselves to a door. Sometimes it's just handing out literature. Other times it's making negative statements about people who go in for abortion. The Biden administration used 18 U.S.C. 241 many times. And right up until the end of the administration, they were putting people in jail. And what the penalties are, it's up to 10 years in jail and monetary fines. They were far less violent and aggressive than the campus protesters that we saw after October 7th. Particularly if you look at UCLA, MIT, Columbia, Harvard, you know the stories, and even Cooper Union in New York, where there were roving gangs attacking Jewish students, trying to intimidate them, inciting hatred, closing down parts of campus for access to Jewish students. And there's a famous case at UCLA where there was a checkpoint where they were physically blocking visibly Jewish students from crossing onto campus. One of the things that President Trump did in his first executive, one of the first executive actions, was to issue an executive order that directed the attorney general to, and this is a quote, employ appropriate civil rights enforcement authorities such as 18 U.S.C. 241 to combat anti-Semitism. So in just as a very sort of short version of this, the three statutory provisions, 18 U.S.C. 241, 242, and 245, prevent a series of types of actions to protect, to stop people from exercising their constitutional and federally protected rights. It could be exercise of religion. It could be simply moving from one place to the other. It could be gathering. It could be associating. And these rights are all protected not by, only by the Constitution, but also by this statute, 18 U.S.C. 241. We asked, we went to Congress and we met with a few congressmen. We said, no, look, these laws are on the book. They're applicable. They're very applicable. It's the same type of activity that was being used to incite violence against African-Americans after slavery, as well as to suppress their rights. Why isn't Merrick Garland enforcing this? We couldn't get an answer. And luckily, my own representative in Congress, Ryan Zinke, from Montana, took it up as his cause. He wrote a letter to Merrick Garland and said, you need to enforce these laws. They're on the books. They're applicable. Do something. And unfortunately, Merrick Garland didn't do anything. Right now, we're not sure whether Pam Bondi is doing anything on them. It's one of those things with the Department of Justice where you never know really until a case is brought what is going on. We hope that they're using 18 U.S.C. 241, which is the most applicable, which talks about conspiracies. There's also another one, 18 U.S.C. 242, which has to do with under color of law, which would apply in the in situations where you have public universities and the faculty and the staff are joining with these pro-Hamas protesters. That's color of law. So there's a second criminal provision that could be applied. And then there's a third one, 18 U.S.C. 245, which has to do with either sometimes it's applied where there's a protected category. Other times it's where there's just a threat or use of force. But again, it's specifically applicable to public education and federally funded programs. And when you conspire to deprive people of their rights to enjoy those benefits of the government, it is a violation of the KKK laws. We have asked many times for it to be enforced. We hope it's going to be enforced, but it's a very powerful tool. When you think about, like, for example, Title VI will not reach the individuals who are actually doing these things on campus. It only applies to the institution. These laws apply to the individuals and the groups that are behind it. 10 years in prison is a long time in prison. You know, someone, source, whoever would fund paying the fines that are assessed to the individuals, you cannot substitute somebody going to prison for you. If you are found guilty of these violations of these statutory provisions, it's 10 years in prison. Just like it was done with the abortion protesters, it should also be done with the pro-Hamas protesters on campus. And I think I'm done with my time here. So if there's any other questions, we could probably talk about them later on in this seminar.
Thank you, Mark Greendorfer. Robert Shibley, do you care to go next?
Sure, I'll go next. Yeah, so since October 7th, 2023, the conflict on campus between the pro-Israel and pro-Jewish and pro-Palestinian protesters has really occupied the majority of FIRE's time on the campus front. And we found ourselves in a cultural place that colleges were really ill prepared to deal with, which is particularly concerning given the, you know, since my entire time at FIRE, and I know even before that, the whole insistence on diversity, tolerance, inclusion, et cetera, that campuses have spent so many billions and so many hours and alienated so many people of various stripes over. And then none of that seemed to make a difference when this conflict blew up on October 7th. And so we've been trying to preserve the freedom of expression in a very difficult environment. And where a lot of that has come around, and then there's been a bunch of different methods that the Trump administration has used particularly, but this is actually a bipartisan issue. The use of Title VI in order to try to clamp down on what is a mix sometimes of protected expression and unprotected conduct, and is sometimes just protected expression in general. It was interesting that Mark Goldfeder had pointed out that Title VI, he's not sure Title VI will work. It's important to remember that Title VI actually predates the idea of hostile environment harassment. It is it's an anti-discrimination law. It's not a anti-harassment law. And so a lot of doctrines have been grafted onto it over the years. And it's largely a judge-made law on how that applies. And so like Mark Goldfeder was saying, FIRE has called, for one of the things we've called for is for the Marcus Doctrine to actually be made law. While there are reasons that religion wasn't included in Title VI originally, has to do with, I think they largely had to do with the fact there's so many religious universities and they were concerned that, the sort of things that they had to do for religious reasons would be considered discrimination. I don't think that, applies when it comes to this kind of invidious discrimination against individual Jewish students who are allowed on campuses. But what we've really struggled with over the last couple of years is this mix of activity on campus that colleges have refused to address, even when it clearly violates their own rules and or the law. And then when forced to address it, either by public pressure or by the government, they have decided, I think both parties, campuses and the government, decide to lump both protected expression like opposition to Israeli policy or opposition to Zionism, the idea that, the exact contours borders or whether there should be a modern state of Israel, et cetera, some of which is political opposition and some of which is, you know, ethnic or racial opposition that is being disguised as political opposition. And what we've definitely learned is that nobody is very well up to the challenge of distinguishing those two. Just a couple examples of the from the HHS's letter to Harvard, their findings letter that Harvard engaged in a violation of Title VI by allowing a hostile environment on its campus. You know, one of the things for which Harvard was faulted was not banning the Palestine Solidarity Committee shortly after they, you know, effectively released a statement supporting Hamas just a couple of days after the October 2023 attacks. You know, and they're and not punishing them for their expression there. They Harvard didn't get around to punishing them until you know, several violations of other rules had already occurred, and they're being faulted by the Office for Civil Rights at Health and Human Services for not taking action against this group based on their expression. You know, I have very little doubt that there is probably a mix of activity there, but we can only go by, you know, what HHS is actually saying in its letter. You know, another example was being faulted for, you know, not going after Harvard student faculty groups for posting this cartoon from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee back in 1967 that had somebody with the Star of David, you know, holding a I think an Egyptian leader and a black leader in a noose. And they were, you know, implying that basically the same sort of abuse is going on right now. Again, that was actually, it's interesting to read about it. It was controversial at the time that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee published that, and it's also you know, it continued to be controversial now. But again, you know, very clearly an instance of protected expression that can't be punished in isolation by itself. And so the question is, how are colleges and how is the government trying to, if they are at all, trying to isolate out those protected areas of expression from the unlawful activity that's going on? And also this what FIRE is sort of calling this cumulative theory of harassment under Title VI, which is that the unrelated activities of different perpetrators can all be combined to make one larger hostile environment that the government faults for being aimed at all Jewish students. And of course, it would be, you know, extensible to other groups down the road. How do you aggregate? How is it fair to the speaker? You know, if you're the 1,000th speaker to come in and say from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. If you're that's all you've done and you're in isolation, isn't that protected speech? Well, yes, it clearly is. But it seems like that protection is being removed once you're aggregated with some number of people from a year or two before and over the years. I think it is a confusing thing to try to consider. And unfortunately, I don't think that we are yet at a point where government or universities have the capability to make those decisions. And it is, you know, in FIRE's opinion, like eroding the protections for free expression that we see on our campuses. I want to suggest, and then I'll stop because I know I'm about to run out of time here. One of the most frustrating things about this as a civil rights and civil liberties organization is there are these other approaches that colleges and universities could take. They don't have to go down the approach of even getting near the expression, purely protected expression in order to put a stop to most of the activity on campus that has been so objectionable. UCLA, a letter came out today talking about, some findings against UCLA, I think, from the Department of Justice. And I mean, we're talking about a university that allowed people to bring construction materials onto their campus and start hammering them together and build barriers. I mean, that's not not the kind of thing, you know, this is Los Angeles. You can't just go around building things without a permit, even if it's your house and it burned down recently. And yet somehow UCLA is allowing that to happen. And, you know, this goes on for weeks. And so we would really like to see, you know, these other alternatives that have to do with that clearly have to do with behavior and not expression be tried first before we get into the business of trying to parse through whether a particular speaker is hostile to Jewish people generally, hostile to the modern state of Israel, hostile to some part of the policy, et cetera. And so that's been occupying our time and I know occupying the time of many others since October 7th. I sure wish the war would be over. Thanks.
Thank you. And now, Mark Stern, I guess you are batting cleanup.
I never batted cleanup in my life, Ken. I was lucky to be allowed to play. So a number of things. First of all, I've forgotten which famous First Amendment a scholar wrote it, but he made the point that at junctures of social discontinuity and disruption, that's when most free speech law gets made. And so it's hardly surprising that we find ourselves talking a lot about freedom of speech because there's this major social disruption. I'm going to talk mostly about Title VI. It exempts religion because the Catholic Church in 1964 persuaded Congress that its nursing homes could no longer prefer Catholics for admission if Title VI were amended to include religion directly. And so we go through what Ken fashioned, Jews as an ethnic group or Muslims as an ethnic group, which at least in the case of Jews is probably actually demographically accurate now. Number of Jews who affiliate through non-religious organizations is actually, I think, more than 50% or close to it. So it's a realistic evaluation of where we are. Second, while the discussion necessarily in a legal gathering is mostly legal, I would echo what several of you have said, which is that in large measure, the failure of university administrators to respond appropriately, I would jokingly refer to the need for spinal transplants for university presidents. They had neutral time, place, and manner restrictions, which could have been used, weren't. In many cases, Columbia is an example, but UC Berkeley was pretty much the same. They refused to cooperate with the police. Faculty Senate at Columbia ties itself into knots, objecting to calling the police when students take over a building. And the university presidents looked at their belly buttons, in effect, while all this was going on. That would have made this all a lot easier had there been more cooperation and action on that front, as several of you have said. I think there's no question if you look at Title VI and there's very broad authority for the government, and presumably, therefore, because so far private actions are allowed to enforce Title VI, I think there's a lot of room to use Title VI in the sort of blocking entrance to a building to Zionists, for example. I think there's, aside from all the other civil rights laws that are available, we've only scratched the surface here today. There's lots that could be done. It would be a lot easier to do, for instance, if universities gave you videos of who broke into a building or who blocked people. They're not doing that. You can have all the laws you want. If you can't get the evidence, you can't win a case. So that all needs to be addressed. I think there's a hole in our constitutional law generally that the government has no liability when private actors deny people constitutional rights, the famous child foster care case. And so you have presidents calling off the police who are ready to arrest people disrupting speech. And the president, at least two or three cases I can think of, says, no, don't do that. Haverford College is defending a Title VI case on the ground that if we would have interrupted people disrupting a Jewish event, we would have made things worse. So in effect, the rioters set the norm for what's acceptable behavior. Unfortunately, it was a guidance letter in the Biden administration that talked about how they would apply Title VI to current controversies. And they omitted actually physical blocking access to a thing. So we wrote them a letter saying, like, seriously, that's literally a violation of Title VI. You're literally denying somebody full access, and they would not amend the guidance. So these are things I think we can do, without stress, and should not be controversial, although there are, to be sure, First Amendment scholars, I think some of you are in Chicago, who take the position, if you're engaged in political conduct, none of these rules can be applied to prevent you from speaking. Well, that's got to be dealt with and defeated on an intellectual grounds and the law reviews and so on. I think at the end of the day, the lingering problem here is defining the boundary between harassment, hostile environment, and protected First Amendment activity. That is really, I think, the hardest issue that's left here. I don't think it's helpful or accurate to just sort of brush that problem aside. It's very easy to deal with it. It's not. And what I would leave people with is this. Every rule, Title VI does not have, nor should it have, a special rule for anti-Semitism. So as we think of theories, the anti-terrorism theory would be in a different place. But as you think of theories to punish speech that creates a hostile environment, you have to think about, at the same time, what would happen if it were used against Jewish students. There was a bill introduced in New York this year that would have lowered the standard for a hostile environment to anything beyond a mere inconvenience. That sort of brings you up. It would bring religious harassment, racial harassment, up to where sexual harassment is in New York. I have real doubts about the constitutionality of applying it to sexual harassment, but they wanted to extend it. So I said to the people who were supporting it in the Jewish community, I said, okay, what happens when Palestinians bring claim that celebrating Yom HaTzmaut on campus triggers them and makes them feel uncomfortable? What are you going to say then? And the answer was, well, fix it, but we have to do something. Well, that's not a helpful answer. I don't have a full program here. I don't know what the answer is. Robert's the only non-Mark on the panel. Welcome to being a minority, Robert. David Cole of the ACLU said, well, the first 999 people who sing From the River to the Sea are not guilty of harassment. The thousandth person is, and that imposed an obligation. That's not a, he obviously recognizes the problem. He doesn't have an answer. I think the answer that some in our community say is that anything that makes people feel uncomfortable ought to be considered discrimination is simply not consonant with the First Amendment, then in any event leads to the sorts of problems I've identified. This really requires, I think, a lot of hard work on our community, on our part, others, to figure out what the answer is. It's not to let anything happen and to ignore the fact that college kids, are more social than old men like I am. And on the other hand, not to sweep so broadly, that's create other problems and cause deficits in what's made American colleges and universities stand out. And that's true of some of the remedies that are being talked about now with regard to universities. The absence of good activity, permissible activity, clearly permissible activity by university administrators leaves a vacuum, which people are going to fill, and not necessarily wisely, because you're confronted with, we're going to do nothing, everything goes, you're on your own. That leads to bad results also. So I leave you only with, this is a hard problem. We really need to think it through, but not take abstract positions on one side or one extreme side or the other, because that's not going to get us through this in ways that will be helpful.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you all. As our audience rushes to their Q&A button with questions for the panel, let me ask whether any of you have brief follow-up comments in response to any of the other panelists. I'll start. This is entirely optional. If you don't, you don't. But let me just ask Mark Goldfeder, do you have anything to add?
Sure. I want to be clear as well. You know, hate speech, no matter how offensive, is protected by the First Amendment. But assault and battery, arson, trespassing, vandalism, breaking and entering, destruction of property, criminal possession of weapons, harassment, true threats, those are all examples of unlawful anti-Semitic behaviors, in some cases hate crimes, that have happened in the last few months and that can and should be regulated. So halavai, if only we were sitting here having a discussion about how to parse the hard questions of when exactly a particular phrase crosses over. If we would deal with the bulk of what we just described a second ago, I think we'd be in a much, much better place.
Thank you. Mark Greendorfer.
Yeah, and building on, again, what Mark Goldfeder said, it is definitely the case that we are very sensitive to the idea that we don't want to suppress speech. I mean, one of the things about campus environments is that you are supposed to be challenged. You're supposed to force yourself to think and maybe even think about uncomfortable things. But I look at other areas of law. You know, there was, I think about 20 years ago, the SEC promulgated some regulations about insider trading. It was called, I think, fair disclosure. What they said is that you look at the mosaic of information and you make an assessment based on that, whether someone had disclosed a insider trading type of information. You look at what's going on campuses and you cannot parse the speech from the conduct. It is all part of their plan. Their plan is to silence Jews, prevent Jews from accessing education, intimidate Jews into dropping Zionism as part of their identity. And so when you look at the First Amendment issues here, I mean, it's going to have to be the Supreme Court who makes this decision, but there has to be some element of the mosaic of what is going on says that this is violating Title VI. It's violating First Amendment rights of other parties. And that's ultimately where it's going to end up, is at the highest court.
Thank you. Robert Chibley?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree that I think this is going to eventually end up at the Supreme Court to try to figure this out. And, you know, the difficulties with trying to parse out what is political speech versus what is speech that could lead to a hostile environment, because I mean, one of the things about protests is that part of what they are intended to do is to make the environment, well, what you would think of in sort of a layperson's terms as the environment. You see this protest and you say, oh, you know, they don't want to accept white supremacy, or they don't want to accept Jim Crow, you know, whatever it is. That's part of the message. And so we have to figure out some way to allow that to be open and require people to convince one another rather than silence one another. But it is very complicated. It is a complicating factor that I think it is true that the particularly the pro-Palestinian efforts on this side there. I think there is a conscious effort by, you know, probably, you know, some state and non-state actors from abroad too. I mean, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything here, but to, you know, make things as difficult as possible within the legal and societal framework that we have here in the U.S. And, you know, so far we have not, managed to match ourselves to the occasion. I do think that, you know, the first thing to do would be to just enforce the rules that we have on the books about that and see what that does. The fact that that hasn't been obvious to college presidents, even after 2 years and whatever number of presidents we're on at Columbia, I think we're on the third. It's a job I think I might never agree to take, no matter how much you gave me. You would think they would have gotten that message yet, but I don't think it has sunk in.
Thank you. Mark Stern?
I would just add that in response to Robert's last comment, there's a cadre of university presidents that are aware of where they went wrong and are working to correct it. Those of us outside academia sometimes don't appreciate the institutional restraints on presidents. And I think of the president and just decrees. And faculty have been a major problem here. I've heard university presidents say, you know, we know who the bad actors are, but they've got tenure and there's very little we can do it. I would add that probably one of the hardest, and I know I keep pointing to things as hard problems, but one of the most difficult problems is the sort of intellectual inbreeding in some departments. You simply can't get a job in most ethnic studies departments, including some measured Jewish studies departments, if you don't believe in critical race theory. It would be unheard of for a critic of critical race theory to be hired in a Black studies department. And the Middle East departments suffer from more or less the same problem. How to deal with that without trampling the academic freedom of institutions, the autonomy of institutions, and the right of people to say things that we don't agree with is also a very hard problem. And it's not gotten the attention it deserves, because we can solve quickly the problem of non-enforcement of neutral time, place, or manner restrictions. That just requires spying. The question of how you deal with faculty intellectual monopolies, exclusivist monopolies, is far more difficult, but it's far more important for the long-term health of our universities and for the well-being of Jewish kids on these campuses.
Good, thank you.
Can I add just one more quick comment?
Sure.
In terms of a framing issue, I just want to push back slightly on one thing, which is I don't think this conversation should be about being pro-Israel versus pro-Palestine. You can be pro-Palestine without being anti-Semitic. You can be anti-Israel without being pro-Hamas. You can even be pro-Hamas without committing crimes. And if you can't tell the difference between being pro-Palestine and providing material support to a terror organization, you're not pro-Palestine, you're supporting Hamas. And if you believe you can't be pro-Palestine without being anti-Semitic, you're not pro-Palestine, you're an anti-Semite. And so I think we should really distinguish here. This is not and has never been about shutting down the speech of people who are pro-Palestine. It's about people who I think were violating the rights of others for whatever reason.
Thank you, Mark. So let me ask this question of everyone other than Mark Goldfeder. If I heard correctly, Mark suggested that Title VI doesn't work.
Mark doesn't cut it here, Ken.
Mark has raised the issue that I would like others to address. He has suggested that Title VI doesn't work, and that's why he uses other avenues, other tools. At the Brandeis Center, most of our lawsuits are not Title VI cases anymore, and those that are Title VI are also other things as well. Do people agree that Title VI doesn't work? Disagree? Think that it should be fixed, improved? And if so, how? Or maybe you feel otherwise. Who wants to take that one on? Mark Greendorf.
So we've represented a number of students in Title VI complaints, mostly in California, UCLA. And what happened is we watched, in one case, over 5 years, the Department of Education just sort of dragged their feet with the investigation, do nothing. We provided all sorts of evidence. We did Public Records Act requests to get the evidence because the Department of Education wasn't. And at the end of the day, at the end of the Biden administration, there was a settlement agreement reached with the University of California, and that settlement agreement turned our complaints on their head. They essentially blamed the victims, and they said basically that it was the Arab students who were being deprived of their rights, and so the University of California was forced to institute some programs to remedy that. I know that there were some instances of Jewish students fighting back, but that turned the victim into the aggressor. And that's my view of Title VI, is that it's sort of a Solomonic type of endeavor. And it, so far, it has not really helped the problem. It has maybe exaggerated the problem.
Anyone else want to address
that? Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, we're only 2 years in. In lawyers' terms, 2 years is what? The motion to dismiss and not much more. So it's a little bit early, I think, to be pronouncing on Title VI. Matters are not going to be made better by the reduction in staff at the Department of Education. It's simply not possible. I think the tools are there in Title VI. The fact is, no university, no matter how bad its Title IX compliance was, lost funding either. So I don't know if you want universities to be losing funding rather quickly. There are costs to lots of other people when you cut off federal funding. There are some remedies in Title VI that I think probably the government ought to be using more forcefully. There was a talk in Congress this year of introducing a bill to create what are called in the tax code. Look, if you can quote the SEC, I can quote the tax code to a bunch of First Amendment lawyers. There were proposals for what amounted to intermediate sanctions and arguably applicable to the people responsible for the violations. And I think that's a good idea, because the fund cutoffs are the equivalent of capital punishment. The government is understandably, or most administrations are understandably, reluctant to go there. I think if there were intermediate sanctions, and particularly against individuals who were individually responsible, I think that would be very helpful. It's always useful to have an atom bomb in the closet, I suppose, but it's not a weapon that you're going to use often, and particularly not when 20-year-olds are acting over the line. So I think we need to encourage the government to use the other authorities that already has in Title VI, talks about any other remedy allowed in law and equity, talks about voluntary compliance. They need to stiffen what voluntary compliance means, not just feel good statements. But I think it's far premature to be signing off on Title VI, which is not to say you shouldn't use other statutes that are available. Just I wouldn't dismiss Title VI just yet. But look, Columbia and Harvard may yet, which are in the public mind Title VI cases, are going to get the attention of university administrators across the country. And I would expect the next school year to be a lot better than the past ones, precisely because the government is perceived as using those authorities.
Yeah, if I could just say, I don't know that you should give up on Title VI. I'll mention a few quick ways that I think Title VI could be improved. So, you know, number one would be mandating really clear timelines for investigations and remedies, a la Title VII. It's not like it couldn't be done. So, 180-day maximum for resolution.
But there's nothing to it. The Title VII statutory time limits are ignored all the time and have no real impact.
I find that they provide a benchmark, and usually it doesn't go more than double. But again, that's my experience. You could tie federal funds to compliance benchmarks. You could have provisional funding suspension so that if there was a preliminary finding, for example, of a Title VI violation, there would be provisional suspension of discretionary funding until corrective action was actually complete. And this goes to one of the questions in the chat. You could expand the private right of action with penalties for disparate impact under Title VI with penalties for intentional discrimination. So
again, I want to intervene because much of my career was spent fending off for Jewish communities claims of disparate impact. For instance, my favorite case was brought during the Carter administration. It was a nursing home in the Bronx that only served matzah during Passover. And somebody brought a complaint, which actually the government took seriously for a while, that had an adverse impact on non-Jews. And, you know, who can argue with that? Who would eat matzah for 8 days if you didn't have to? Title VI is embedded in a broader pattern of civil rights laws. You have to be careful what you wish for, because you may end up getting it and regretting it in some other context. We are focused today on what's right in front of us, but there's more to worry about.
Very good. So we have only a few more minutes. One of our questioners points out, he argues that much of the campus anti-Semitism problem can be attributed, he believes, to labor unions, and wants us to say a word about suing labor unions. I know the questioner has sued many labor unions. I'll say that we at the Louis D. Brandeis Center have sued a couple. Does anyone want to say a word about that?
Yes, it's a big problem. And like many others, we're also working on it. In fact, with the questioner.
Okay. Very good. So definitely a potential growth area, and one where we have cases before both the NLRB, the EEOC, and the federal courts. Probably quickly one more. As a litigation strategy, is anyone trying to get any of these issues before the U.S. Supreme Court? Or should we?
We're not in the position right now to be trying to bring something on behalf of, I think, plaintiffs to the Supreme Court. But I do think, and maybe this is just my pontificating to some extent, but I do think that the the Supreme, I think this Supreme Court would actually do a pretty good job of trying to make this distinction if it were put in front of it. I think the frustration that, you know, many of us have is that some of these very live controversies, the court seems to be more eager to avoid than would be helpful. And I understand that judicial restraint and sort of modesty, but, you know, particularly when, these kinds of issues are on the line, I think that it would be nice if the Supreme Court would consider sometimes the, you know, the fact that, you know, in this case, if you're even just, you know, going with higher ed, you've got these 4,000 sort of city states, or maybe 2,000 if you want to leave, you know, if you want to go with the residential ones, who are trying to figure out how they should govern themselves to some extent. They need some guidance, and you know, they're not getting it. So it would be nice to see the Supreme Court get a more or less clean case on this, so that we can have some definition and figure it out from there.
So, couple of things. One is the issue has arisen in the Title IX context a couple of times, and the Supreme Court, which is usually fairly anxious to get First Amendment cases, because after all, they beat bankruptcy and tax cases for staying awake, has just refused to enter the area. And they've done the same thing, even with sympathetic plaintiffs in the K-12 space case recently about, you know, there are only two genders on a T-shirt, right, which begged for Supreme Court intervention, and the court turned it down. So, A, you need a clean case. I'm not sure we all agree on what was a clean case, but even if we all agreed on a clean case, it's not entirely clear to me that the Supreme Court is rushing in here when really the best legal minds in the country have not come even to one or two possible theories that would help you solve it. So, well, I wouldn't count on the court not being particularly free speech oriented, because they have been on the whole. But even if you got past that, they just haven't seemed very, very willing to enter these thickets. So I wouldn't spend my time with a litigation strategy that counted on getting there.
Very good. Thank you. So as we prepare to wrap things up, I'll just say to the questioner who says that we've talked a lot about federal law, are there state law claims? There have been state campus anti-Semitism cases, although they're more rare. And we certainly have state anti-Semitism cases outside of the campus context. And they're generally on contract and tort, although in the K-12 context, they're often state education law statutes as well. For the audience member who says that there are so many marks that we should use last names, I would like to thank Messrs. Stern, Greendorfer, Goldfeder, and Shibley, marks and non-marks alike, for a wonderful conversation. This has been, I think, edifying and helpful. Also, thank the Federalist Society and, in particular, Marco Lloyd for putting this all together on behalf of the Civil Rights Practice Group of the Federalist Society. I would like to thank everybody, and I think that Marco Lloyd might have a last word for us.
Well, thank you all for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. I'd also like to thank your audience for joining us. We greatly appreciate your fantastic participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.